Hello and welcome to Animal Voices. Today's Friday, July 27th, 2012. I'm your host, Alyssa Ray. I'm joined in studio today by my co-host, Alon Cohen.
Hello.
Hey, and our certified operator, Jay. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, everybody.
Of course, you're listening to 102.7 FM CFRO. That's Vancouver's co-op radio, broadcasting live from unceded Coast Salish Territory, Canada. Animal Voices is Western Canada's only radio program dedicated solely to animal advocacy and compassionate living, bringing you all the news, events, interviews, and features to keep you up to date with what's happening in Vancouver and beyond. We at Animal Voices believe in a world in which non-human animals live their lives unfettered by exploitation and undue suffering. On today's show, what do we have for you? Lots of great stuff. We're pleased to be speaking with the organizer of the second annual Veg Fest Vancouver, which is just 1 week away on Saturday, August 4th. On the second half of our show today, we feature a conversation with Carl Orzechowski, the director of Maximum Tolerated Dose, a brand new documentary about the ethics of animal testing, which tells the stories of former lab workers and lab subjects, a topic that hasn't really been covered it before in film. Alon and I were able to preview the film this week, and I myself love the film. I think it's just so beautiful and artistic. I love the music. It's kind of hypnotic, sort of droning, beautiful kind of acoustic music by a band called Weird Visions and Brian W. Bray. And the film is sort of just this beautiful collage of images. What were your impressions, Alon?
I found the film to be very informative, and actually, I mean, like you say, the aesthetics were great. The one thing I really liked about the film, in comparison to other animal advocacy or animal rights films focusing on animal testing, is that it focuses not so much on a philosophical or like a metaphysical tone about the ethics of it, but it actually just features former lab workers and lab technicians, which I feel, they're kind of voices that are subjugated and are oppressed in such a way that they're marginalized. So you usually hear from doctors, you usually hear from people that have high professional roles, and of course there are gender implications, they're usually men. But in the film we hear from a lot of women and a lot of lab technicians who work very closely with the animals in a very intimate and caring manner, such that oftentimes doctors don't actually have access to these kinds of emotional and knowledge states. So I found the film to be really, really eye-opening in terms of that perspective, and I found it to be a really, really powerful perspective.
Yeah, it's definitely the stories that aren't heard, and just hearing firsthand accounts, like, nothing can really beat that. Like, you can have the whole argument, you know, out there in a vacuum, but hearing people who actually work with these animals and hearing why they got into that and how they got into it and how they justified it while they were doing it, it's really interesting to kind of know that side and see that they're not, you know, evil people or whatever, just for doing work like that. And a lot of harrowing, bold moves out of the industry, which is really interesting to hear. So we'll be featuring that interview at about the halfway point in the show today. And Carl is actually currently on his way to Vancouver for a free screening of the film, which Alon might mention the details of soon.
Will do, yeah.
Thank you. And the tour is called Open the Cages, and we'll ask Carl more about this tour he's doing that incorporates music and demonstrations and screenings of the film and gets local groups who they're visiting to get involved. I think there's also a music show after the screening next week on Saturday night, which should be pretty awesome. Yeah, and I guess what else? Well, let's talk about what we did this week. Last night, we both attended a pretty awesome capacity event at Rhizome. Can you tell us a bit about that, Alon?
Sure. Well, what it was the coming out party of the Black Pawprint Collective. It's a new collective that's come out in Vancouver in response to basically a lack or a gap, as they say, of animal rights organization, animal rights advocacy within the Vancouver and BC scene that takes a very explicitly anti-capitalist, anti-patriarchal, and anti-colonial role. And while there has been a lot of great animal advocacy work done in Vancouver, not much of it takes a very explicit stance against capitalism, such that they realize that things like private property relations and other kinds of factors really hamper and mark the oppression of animals. So this is the coming out party, and what exactly it was is there was a film by Marshall Curry. The film was If a Tree Falls. It was a story of the Earth Liberation Front, and there was also stories from this writer, a writer for Fourth Struggle magazine and the Moment of Insurrection blog. His name was Dee. But regarding the film, I found it to be really moving. I don't know how you felt about the film, Alyssa, but personally, it seemed to be very interesting and quite confusing, in the sense of that you feel the frustration of these activists. Essentially what the film was about is about the Earth Liberation Front, and I'm not so sure how many of you know about it, but what it is, it's very similar to the Animal Liberation Front, whereas it's an underground cell, or various underground cells across the US and Canada, across the world really, that take more explicitly property damage destruction tactics towards it. So for instance, they will burn down forestry companies, or they'll burn down slaughterhouses and things like that to very markedly show, you know, this is a war that we're fighting against. And on the one hand, you feel the frustration of these activists who have been 10 years onwards protesting in a very, one could say in a very civil manner on the streets and nothing happening, and then all of a sudden taking their frustration a step forward and engaging these tactics of arson. But at the same time, you realize a lot of these tactics don't really work, and they're caught in a kind of double bind, because it feels, you know, on the one hand, you don't really know what to do watching the film at the end of it, because you feel sympathized with them, but you understand that their tactics obviously are problematic, and yet the other tactics, simple protesting in the street, also hasn't been effective historically.
Hasn't been? I don't know about that. I don't know. I mean, not effective maybe right away, but I don't know. I think there's a really important place for public demonstrations, letter writing, and that kind of thing. I don't just want to just say not effective. And
yeah, I definitely wouldn't want to put aside. I mean, personally, for myself, I see these kinds of actions, and, you know, street actions and things like that, more effective in terms of community building and changing the relationships we have with one another in a community. Whether or not they're effective for the targets, I'm not so sure, but they're definitely, in terms of public awareness, public spirit, and making the activist community feel more alive, they're definitely very effective. But what was the one striking thing in the movie that I remember is that, you know, there was a community somewhere in Eugene, Oregon, where there was a slaughterhouse for essentially horses. There was a horse slaughterhouse, and they've been protesting the slaughterhouse for 10 years. And then one day, these group of individuals decided, you know what, let's just burn the slaughterhouse down. They burn it down, and the slaughterhouse cannot open up again. So on the one hand, you can see that as being successful, but I'm not so sure if horse slaughter ended in Oregon, if it just moved to other places and they rebuilt. It wasn't very clear about that. So
yeah,
again, it's not very, you know, these tactics are not very clear as to how effective they are. And you definitely get the sense of frustration among the people that want to take these actions.
Yeah, definitely. Hearing their stories was really powerful, and it's really sad, the justice system and how the media sort of treats these people and paints them as eco-terrorists. I thought it was a really successful event last night. It was packed, and I think it opened a lot of people's eyes. And it's really sad, though, at the end that the protagonist that we're following, like, heads
Danny
off
McGowan.
To jail for 8 years.
And he's coming out in December of 2012.
Really?
Yeah, so he's looking for a job. That's what I've heard.
Exciting. Well, good. We're just going to share a little message with y'all and come back with the events.
Animal Voices celebrates the glory of the animal kingdom.
But the rise of factory farming of animals has created an appalling situation, so that every hour in Canada, some 56,000 animals are killed for meat. They were mostly raised in inhumane conditions.
Your tax dollars fund government policies and programs that promote industrial livestock production, that puts family farmers out of business and wreaks havoc on the environment.
If you feel that all animals are sentient beings that feel pain and are capable of loving and being loved, this program is for you.
Animal Voices, Fridays at noon on CFRO Co-op Radio 102.7 FM.
So this is the Animal Voices show. The events for today, Friday, July 27th, 2012. There's quite a lot happening in the next couple of days. Tonight, on July 27th, there is the Art Against Edenbridge auction. You can meet the crew of the caravan to stop the pipelines, view wild and weird art, and try the Southwest specials and craft brews. It's all ages and it's by donation. It's featuring the artists Compassion Gorilla, Star, and 99 Buck. The online catalog can be seen at wildcoast.ca/art. The Art Against Enbridge auction tonight is happening at 7 p.m. at Kenoti Lounge. That's 768 Yates Street. And so all the donations of art and other items are still being accepted, and they already thank your donations. On Monday, July 30th, at 6:30 p.m. And the actual event starts at 7 p.m., there's actually going to be a fundraiser for the Action Camp at the Illness Totem Action Camp, which is the action camp going on in North BC in the Wet'suwet'en territory where the pipelines are going to be built. So there's going to be a fundraiser for this camp, and so it's about $20 to $25 per ticket, and it's at Grandview Calvary Baptist Church. That's 1803 East First Avenue, just east of Commercial Drive, on Monday. And so, of course, they want people to come by and really help out and donate for the action camp, so the people up there can really build the community and the struggle that's going to be taking place against the pipelines. Next Friday, on August 3rd at 7 p.m., if you've ever heard of the book Deep Green Resistance, it's quite popular. It came out a couple of years ago. I believe it was co-edited by the writer Derek Jensen. At the Purple Thistle Center at 260-7975 Vernon Drive, Vancouver, BC. That's in the east side. Deep Green Resistance is going to be doing a speaking tour of the West Coast to promote the upcoming action camp that I just spoke about. So again, this action camp is going to be a blockade in the pathway of the proposed pipeline. So at the Purple Thistle Center, you can bring donations such as tents, rope, white gas, fuel, climbing gear, tarps, etc., money, anything else that could be really useful in a camp, and come hear the writers of Deep Green Resistance tour speak. Also on Friday, August 3rd, at 7 p.m. to 9:30 p.m., there's going to be the screening of Maximum Tolerated Dose, the interview of which we'll be hearing later in the show. So, like Alyssa said earlier, it's a Canadian documentary by Decipher Films and Carl Ozakowski, with a soundtrack by Weird Vision and Brian W. Bray. It's part of the Open Cages tour, and seating is limited. Be sure to bring a friend who doesn't know about animal testing, because, of course, you want to reach large audiences as possible. So it's going to be at 7 p.m. at the Vancouver Central Library. On the next day, on Saturday, August 4th, at 11 a.m., there's going to be actually a Veg Fest happening in Vancouver. It's going to be at Granville at Georgia in Vancouver, BC. It starts at 11, goes throughout the day. So it's Veg Fest 2012, and it's the second year that's happening on Saturday, August 4th. It'll be located right in the heart of downtown Vancouver, and they'll be taking over Granville Street between Robson and Georgia. There'll be vegan food vendors, animal protection organizations, and much more. Also on Friday, both this Friday and next week Friday, it's Fantastic Friday Nights, and it's going to be happening at Fortune Garden Seafood Restaurant at 1475 West Broadway. It's part of the weekly actions by the Vancouver Animal Defense League, which takes protesting for shark fin soup, and this time it's going to be at the Fortune Garden Seafood Restaurant, like I said. So you can definitely go out and help them protest shark fin soup, and hopefully they can bring an end to it. They've been very, very successful in their campaigns around BC, banning in various principalities. So it's a really exciting campaign. If you really are kind of new to activism and protesting, it's definitely a campaign you should go check out and help out, because it's got a lot of momentum and energy, and it's kind of really uplifting and inspirational. So that's been your events for today. And what do we have next? We have an interview, it seems.
Yes, we do. VegFest Vancouver is just 1 week away on Saturday, August 4th. And Jonathan, the organizer, joins us to share a bit more about the event and get us pumped and excited. Thanks for joining us today, Jonathan.
Thank you for having me.
You are very welcome. It is our pleasure. So first of all, for those who don't know, can you just give us a rundown of what VegFest is and all that it includes?
Sure. VegFest Vancouver is a street festival happening on August 4th from 11 a.m. till 7 p.m. It's right downtown on Granville Street between Georgia and Robson, so like the busiest part of town on the long weekend. So it's going to be crazy busy. There's the fireworks happening that night as well. So downtown's just going to be packed with people, and they're all going to see our festival with vegan message and vegan vendors and animal rights organizations, and it should be a great time.
Awesome. That's really exciting. I think it's a great location. So can you tell us a bit about the entertainment for the day and what sorts of activities or what can people do when they arrive at VegFest?
So this year, we're really focusing on the vendors and the nonprofit organizations. So it's more a display of everything that is vegan in Vancouver. So so there'll be businesses showing their stuff. There'll be food to eat, just lots of people to talk to, different organizations to sign up for and sign petitions for and such.
To just get motivated and get educated and reach out. Awesome. So it is all 100% vegan?
Yes, it is.
Wow, nice. And so last year, I think it had sort of stage and entertainment, but you're not taking that on this year, like bands and stuff?
This year we had just some space constraints, so
okay.
We weren't able to do a stage. We are going to try to set up a PA, so there will be some music, just no live music this year, but we're hoping to do that again next year.
Oh, sounds good. I bet you can have an awesome playlist of veg-loving songs.
Yeah, for sure. There's so many like vegan and vegetarian musicians in this city. It's great.
Yeah. Awesome. So tell us, Jonathan, what inspired you to take this project on?
I just wanted to get the vegan message out there, get it in front of people, just where there's going to be lots of people, just get them to see that there's vegans here, there's people who care about animals, care about what they eat, what they take into their body, and just put it out in the street, in front of everyone, where they all can see it.
Awesome. So were you inspired, I wonder, by other vegetarian festivals? I know there's a whole bunch more across the world and more popping up every year. Have you attended other ones that you've really enjoyed or something you aspire to?
I've attended several different festivals and also conferences as well, and they all have kind of a festival aspect to them, and just seeing what they do in different parts of the world too, like even online you can see a lot of photos, and I've seen a lot of indoor festivals and a lot of outdoor festivals, and I really wanted to try to do something outdoors so that people can just kind of stumble upon it.
Yeah, for sure. So last year it was part of Car Free Day on Main Street. How did you feel about the success of that event there?
It was great. We had a huge turnout. Like all of our food vendors were sold out like super early in the day. They had no idea how many people were going to come out for the event. It was really helpful too to be part of a larger event. It did make it a little bit easier to organize things, since it was my first time doing a festival. It kind of helped it along, and also because it was part of a popular festival, it was kind of a guaranteed audience. So it made it less expensive to do the festival because not a lot of money had to be spent in advertising and things like that, and still get a huge turnout.
Yeah, I really love the idea. It's just perfect to just have it in the middle of a street fair where just people have to walk by. Like we're not just in a little corner somewhere or something like that. It's just open, flowing. One sort of funny thing I remember about last year is just kind of noticing people who were like, oh, what's going on? And they'd notice that what it was, and then they would just look straight ahead and just kind of power through. It's just like they're like, I don't want to know what's happening with animals, which is, yeah.
But the great thing is like even if they don't stop, it still affected them, and they're going to end up thinking about it for the rest of the day.
Yeah, it's another drop in the bucket, as I call it. You never know when that one last drop is going to sort of make things kind of pour over and help people open their hearts. So, yeah, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
So this is... I was just like, what's your dream for the event? What do you see as the objective?
The hope is just to keep expanding. This year we've got one block of Granville Street, and there's actually five blocks available. So in future years, I want to expand and just make it into a huge event that people are always talking about and always hoping to they plan their summer plans around going to VetFest, and exposing the message not only of there's animals here that need protection and we should think about them when we make choices related to diet and lifestyle, but also that veganism is here, it's accessible, it's tasty, like all of the reasons that you can think of that someone might be vegan, just get everyone to think about it and associate it with our city, and try to make Vancouver the vegan city.
Yeah, definitely. We're on the West Coast. There's a lot of strong cities. I think people most think about Portland or New York as like the top veg cities. We really have the potential to be the most amazing vegan city in Canada, and I think VegFest mm-hmm. is going to be a big part of that. So yeah, kudos to you for organizing it. So it is just a week away, and I want to know what is needed to make it a huge success, and how can people help? If can they get involved this late in the game, and how can they do that?
Yeah, we can always benefit from more volunteers for the day of the event. We need volunteers from 9 a.m. to start setup all the way to about 8:30 when we're done packing up at the end of the day. And there's a variety of volunteer positions too. So for those who are really outgoing and want to talk to people, there's info booths and fundraising and stuff like that. But for those who are a little more shy, they can just kind of keep the general peace, watch over the festival and things like that. There's something for everyone, and on our website you can just sign up, say what you're interested in doing, and we'll just schedule you in for the day. So anytime from now, pretty much right up until the festival, we invite people to sign up as volunteers.
Oh, great. And can you remind us the website and how to get in touch?
The website is vegfestvancouver.com.
Awesome. Well, I hope people, get involved and come out. It is the long weekend, and I know a lot of people are maybe planning on going away, camping or something like that, but there's so much going on in the city that week, and VegFest is the premier event. There's also the free screening on Friday, and then there's a vegan punk show on that Saturday night, so lots going on and lots of reasons to stay in town. And, just, again, thanks so much for organizing this awesome festival. I think we're going to just play a little song here. But, thanks again, and we'll see you at VegFest.
Okay, thank you, too.
Take care.
It's Matsuri time. The 36th Annual Powell Street Festival returns to Oppenheimer Park on August 4th and August 5th with the biggest Japanese-Canadian cultural celebration in the nation.
Enjoy traditional and contemporary Japanese-Canadian arts and culture, including taiko drumming, sumo wrestling, martial arts, folk and modern dance, film screenings, tea ceremonies, as well as a fantastic array of Japanese food, crafts, and displays.
This year, explore the Jackson Street Block Party, a designated commerce area offering a new type of curated shopping and display experience at the festival. Spend your BC Day-long weekend at the longest-running community celebration in Vancouver. For a complete lineup, go to PowellStreetFestival.com.
listening to Animal Voices Radio on Vancouver's Cooperative Radio CFRO 102.7 FM, broadcasting live from unceded Coast Salish territories, Canada. Here are your headlines for July 27, 2012. For those of you who have been following the Sea Shepherd campaign and know of Paul Watson's arrest in Germany, German news sources say that a German court has ordered environmental activist Paul Watson of the group Sea Shepherd to be re-arrested, saying Wednesday that he skipped bail and apparently has left the country. So that's not so good news for him. The 61-year-old Canadian was first arrested on May 13th at Frankfurt Airport on a Costa Rican warrant that claimed that he had endangered the crew of a fishing vessel a decade ago. Watson was released days later on a €250,000 bond and ordered to report regularly to authorities while Costa Rica's extradition request was considered. His attorney now says that his client informed him by telephone that he has left Germany for unknown destination. The Hesse Regional Court in a statement said, noting that Watson has failed to report to authorities since Sunday. So you can keep on lookout for that news, because that's been quite exciting stuff with Paul Watson and Sea Shepherd. An advocacy group comprised of medical doctors and other healthcare professionals has petitioned the United States Congress to ban milk from school lunches, arguing that high levels of saturated fat, sugar, and contaminants in milk contribute to the epidemic of childhood obesity. Milk doesn't make children grow taller and stronger, but it can make them heavier, says Suzanne Levin, a registered dietitian with the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, that's PCRM. We are asking Congress and the USDA to put children's interests above the interests of the dairy industry. Focusing on milk as the single most important source of calcium in children's diets distracts schools and parents from foods that can actually build bones, like beans and leafy greens. The PCRM says the current arrangement, which has required milk to be served in schools for over 50 years, is due to a push from the dairy industry, which has a vested financial stake in the continued consumption of milk by school children. The federal government spends more money on dairy products than any other food item in a school lunch program, the PCRM points out. The other piece of news that we have, the other headline, is that a couple of days ago there was a vigil in Vancouver for Captain the Dog. And for you, those of you who aren't aware of the story, many people have been touched by the story of the 2-year-old German Shepherd who was found badly injured in a dumpster in Kitsilano and later died. A couple of nights ago, many people showed up for a vigil in honor of Captain. And there's been a lot of talk about the event over the last few days over social media. The vigil was held at 7 p.m. at Kitsilano Beach near the tennis courts, and for people who went, they brought, of course, candles and their own pets. Marcy Moriarty of the BCSPCA wasn't surprised by the public's outrage to the story. She calls tragic. The closest I've seen, of course, was with respect to the sled dogs incident. I think people don't tolerate this type of thing in our province, she explains. An online campaign has raised over $65,000 for the SPCA's investigation. Unfortunately, we respond to 7,000 animal cruelty complaints each year, and the vast majority, of course, do not involve this type of brutal and intentional cruelty, but some do, as Moriarty. Captain was found with serious cuts and bruises and died of a heart attack last week. Police are still looking for his owner. And I don't know how you feel about this story, Alyssa, but this is something, you know, I may be a bit ostracized from the animal rights community for saying this, but this is a kind of a story, and when hearing about this, you know, I'm kind of upset with the amount of money that's being raised, because I feel somewhat annoyed and bothered by the fact that we have individual cases of people or of animals that become these tragic stories and raise so much money for these individual investigations and for these individual campaigns, rather than changing the structural causes, you know, rather than, I mean, $65,000 is a tremendous amount of money. If those went into better campaigns for making harsher penalties or laws, or, I mean, perhaps we shouldn't be advocating for harsher laws, we should be advocating for better community involvement, for better educational programs. And I feel somewhat disheartened by the fact that campaigns, you know, we have so many struggling campaigns. Mercy for Animals doesn't get a lot of money. Campaigns like Liberation BC is struggling for funds in Vancouver, and yet we get $65,000 for an individual case. Tragic as it may be, it sounds to me, it's you know, knowing how hard it is to continue stability for organizations and get funding, it's a bit disheartening to see money being funded towards these individual cases. I don't know how you feel about this.
I can't really agree more there, actually. And yeah, just there's these little cases, they get blown up in the media, and really people aren't then drawing the conclusions or thinking, okay, what does this mean? It's just this issue. And then it's gone, and people forget about it, too, in like a couple weeks or something. Like, and then there's another like single issue or single event or something. And yeah, we're not really thinking deeper, and yeah, not only the money, but just like the suffering of that one animal. Well, what about the suffering of, you know, so many other animals in industries that profit off of?
It reminds me very much. It's very similar to instances where we have individual instances where animals, more specifically cows, happen to escape slaughterhouses, and then those cows are moved to, you know, zoos, and people feel a lot of they feel a lot for these animals, their heart goes out to them, and then, you know, a big ruckus is made over that. But I feel what actually happens when we, you know, make these individual animals that escape from slaughterhouses heroes, it kind of it takes the discomfort of what these animals symbolize in the realm of the slaughterhouse and takes them outside of that. All of a sudden now they're heroes and they're in zoos, and we forget about the connections that they have to all these other animals in slaughterhouses, and it's a kind of way to detach them from their context, and it makes us feel more comfortable when we do these kind of things, when structural causes, you know, really are still in the way. And, you know, this is not something that's intrinsic or just manifested within animal rights. Of course, we see individual cases where certain people themselves get lots of funding, where structural causes for unfortunate events continue unfunded and unabated. Mm-hmm. So the next story we have is that protesters have called for an end of slaughters of horses in Alberta, and the group says that the meat is unsafe for humans. The BC New Democrat MP, Alex Atamaneko, speaks beneath a Stop Slaughtering Us billboard in Calgary on Monday. He said he's the author of the bill C-322M, which will prohibit horse slaughter for human consumption. The BC New Democrat MP said that, of course, the meat of the horses has been unsafe for human consumption, so he's called for the end of the slaughtering of horses. The horse meat industry, however, experts are calling the campaign an unfair attack that appeals to emotion while ignoring the science, quote-unquote, that deems horse meat safe to be eaten by humans. On Monday, more than a dozen horse advocates crowded a grass patch beside Memorial Drive and Barlow Trail, Southeast, for the unveiling of the billboard that shows a picture of two horses beside the heading, Stop Slaughtering Us. The protesters were supporting the bill, that is Bill C-322, and the bill, of course, like I said, seeks to end the import and export of horses for slaughter for human consumption within Canada. And when the United States stopped funding the horse meat inspections in 2006, the MP said Canada's horse meat industry saw a massive influx of horses destined for slaughterhouses. And so, of course, we see two quite significant points to bring out in the story. Of course, the first one being that, you know, we have another instance of people protesting the slaughter of horses, something that seems quite bizarre to me to be continuing, given the fact that what horses represent symbolically in kind of the cultural consciousness. But the other thing, of course, and this is something to be worth mentioning, is notice how the horse meat industry specifically genders their attack by saying it's an unfair campaign because it appeals to emotion while ignoring science, but as if somehow appeals to emotion, namely that emotion, you know, we shouldn't forget the fact, the history of how emotion has been feminized and seen as something that is more applicable towards women. Of course, I don't want to centralize, but that is how it has been historicized and seen within our cultural consciousness. You know, it seems to me ridiculous that, of course, somehow appeals to emotion, the way people feel and how something they feel within their gut viscerally and how they have emotional reactions to things is somehow discounted. And, you know, we have to be unemotional, we have to be detached, disembodied, and we have to appeal to science in itself. And, of course, the science is a different story, that whether or not it's safe for human consumption. But I want to point out that, you know, appeals to emotion aren't something that are in a binary to reason and science, and in and of itself should be something that's legitimized and validated to appeal for. So those have been your headlines with a bit of analysis for today, Friday, July 27th, 2012.
Thanks, Elon. Carl Orzechowski, who publishes his image making under the name Decipher Films, has just released his first feature-length documentary, Maximum Tolerated Dose. And we'll talk about his documentary. Well, actually, I talked to him about it yesterday on the phone, and we will share that interview now. He's actually currently on a West Coast screening tour, and we're excited to share his words. Hello, Carl, and thank you for joining us today on Animal Voices. First of all, kudos to you on the beautiful film. I watched it this week, and it really blew me away. Like, sometimes, you know, you never quite know what to expect from an animal rights-related film, and you kind of brace yourself for ghastly horror. And I was pleasantly surprised when the rich tapestry of music and the collage of images just sort of washed over me and were much more haunting and quite lovely than simply horrific. I wondered if you could first tell us a bit about your approach to filmmaking and your decision to portray a gruesome subject like vivisection in an artistic way.
Well, I've been an animal activist for a bit longer than I've been a filmmaker, but I really got into filmmaking as a way to, you know, as a way to express myself artistically. And so I approach my work from that perspective. I mean, I'm an animal rights activist, obviously, but I consider myself a filmmaker first when I'm working on a film. And so I really wanted to do something that was a bit different, or a lot different, I guess, depending on what you think of the film. And yeah, I just wanted to do something that approached the topic of animal experimentation in a way that hasn't been done before, both in terms of subject matter and in terms of how I treated it visually. So that was kind of my perspective of where I was coming from.
Yeah, it's really quite a visual treat. I really enjoyed it. And the music, too. It just fit with it so well, and it's so beautiful. And I hope to share some of that music at the end of the show. So, yeah, kudos on that. I just wanted to ask you, so this is your first full-length documentary. I know you've covered a range of other topics in your short films and photography. How did you come to land on this topic for your film, and can you tell us a bit about how the idea developed?
Sure. So the idea actually developed from a couple of conversations that I had back in 2010. Essentially, I had two conversations really close together where in one conversation I was talking with someone who I found out was a former lab worker. She used to work in a commercial lab outside of Montreal, when I met her, she was working at a sanctuary, and she was someone that instantly sort of stood out for me because she was just so kind of numbed by the experience. She had obviously seen a lot and been through a lot and was really disturbed by it. But she talked very frankly about her experiences. And then a couple of weeks later, I had a conversation with a former cardiologist who I happened to ask him, you know, he was a cardiologist. He must have at some point either, you know, experimented on animals or used them in training or something like that. And he told me a story about how he used to work in a lab with dogs. And while he did that, he also had dogs at home. That was what eventually led him to actually leave the practice with the cognitive dissonance between him experimenting on and killing dogs in his lab and then going home and, you know, playing with his companion animals. So it was really those two conversations that sort of lit the light bulb over top of my head that made me decide to do the film. And I realized after talking with those two people that there are probably a lot more people out there like them. And so it was at that point, which was about in mid-2010, that I started searching out the stories that would make up the film.
And how did you do that, I wonder? Like, are there support networks out there? Is there any groups for people who used to be involved in this? Or, like, how did you find people after those people you first randomly met?
It still exists. One of the first people that I was introduced to when I was seeking out stories about this was a woman named Rachel Weiss, who appears in the film as well. She used to run and actually still runs a website called the Laboratory Primate Advocacy Group, which, I mean, it's a very specific name, but one of the things that the LPAG also used to do was provide a support forum for current and former lab workers to discuss their experiences, because Rachel had been a lab worker, and she had left her work after, you know, a series of pretty awful experiences that she had. And so she wanted to provide some kind of support to people like her to come out and tell their stories and tell the stories of the animals they worked with. And so that's the only sort of support network that I know of. It kind of went through a dormant period over the last few years, but with the release of the film, I think Rachel was thinking of revamping the website and getting it back out there. My film's website will also sort of provide a contact and support service for current and former lab workers as well.
Oh, good. Thinking of the stories, of course, they're really touching, and I think it's really important for animal rights activists, animal advocates to see inside their minds and hear their stories. I think it's so easy for us sometimes to just sort of demonize people who work in these industries, but of course, if you believe that it's necessary for human health and that, you know, you're doing really important work, then you can kind of sort of understand these people more, I guess. And I think that's really important to empathize with everyone, even if they do happen to be doing things that are cruel to animals.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely see a lot of room for opposition, and I think, you know, there's certainly something to be said for protesting outside of laboratories and causing a ruckus and you know, being oppositional at times. But I also, what I wanted to do with the film was something different. I really wanted to reach a wide audience, and I wanted to act as a bridge, if possible, between animal activists and lab workers, because I think we, as activists, really need them to come out and tell stories about what they've seen and what they've done, because that, you know, further strengthens our cause as well.
Yeah, definitely. And I also really appreciate how, on your website, at least, you say animal advocates do themselves a huge disservice by not familiarizing themselves with the other side. And then you posted links to, you know, pro-vivisection websites. And I think that was a really, really powerful, important point. So thank you for that.
Yeah, I mean, it can be really infuriating to engage with that kind of material. It's frustrating because, you know, in so many ways our whole culture is geared towards the use of animals in different ways, and I think it can be really emotionally difficult to sort of intentionally expose yourself to material that justifies that sort of thing. But it's really important to familiarize ourselves with how different industries talk about what they do and how they justify it internally. I think if we have a better sense of how industries justify things, then, you know, we can approach the individuals that work within those industries in a different fashion, and I think, you know, hopefully be a bit more productive as well.
Yeah, definitely. Good points. So not only do you share the personal stories of ex-lab workers, but also ex-lab animals,
I wonder if you could share a particular story from your film that stands out for you that we can share with our listeners.
Sure. So, actually, the story in the film that was kind of the story that started it all, I mean, in addition to the two people that I spoke with that inspired the film in the sense of talking with former lab workers, there was a former lab monkey that I met at a sanctuary who goes by the name of Darla, and Darla was used, well, the sanctuary knows that for sure she was used at Queen's University, but she may have also come from a different facility as well. She has two tattoo numbers across her chest, and she's someone who is incredibly damaged by her time in the laboratory. She, even though she was released from the lab in 2004, you know, that was 8 years ago now, she still really exhibits a lot of stress behavior and sort of emotional traumatic behavior from that time. So she still, you know, has anxieties over food. She was used in anorexia studies. She fights over food. She has a very sort of low tolerance for new stimuli, having new people around. She will cover her eyes a lot or you know, display anger poses when new people are around or if people get too close to her. I mean, obviously, the sanctuary is not open to the public, but, you know, I have visited there a couple of times, and that's the stuff that I've seen and some of what's discussed in the film. I met her back in 2010 as well, and I had wanted to include her in the film, but I wasn't sure if that would be able to happen, and fortunately, I was able to include her with the permission of the sanctuary director, and I'm really glad that I was able to include her story because, you know, monkeys are used quite extensively in research. I mean, that, you know, of course, they're used in smaller numbers than rats and mice, who have equally awful lives, but, you know, for a lot of different reasons, a mainstream audience can relate to primates much more so than say rats or mice.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was really important for me to include her story, and I'm really glad I was able to.
Yeah, it was really, really sad that she's alone too. It'd be nage if she could have some cage mates, but I guess her
actually she does actually have she has a couple of friends at the sanctuary, but they were sort of taken out during editing because it didn't make sense.
Right.
I mean, you know, every minute is precious in the film, and so it didn't make sense to include just tiny bits of information
right.
about them. She, there was a chance recently that the sanctuary would be able to take a couple of more monkeys to, you know, to be more. You know, so that she could have more friends with her, but unfortunately that wasn't able to happen.
Oh, okay, good. Well, thanks for filling me in on that. So I wanted to talk just a bit about your tour, actually. You're at the tail end of a West Coast screening tour. I wonder if you could tell us about the aims of the Open the Cages tour and about how that came together.
So the Open the Cages tour was really organized very much by a friend of mine named Mike XBX, who is currently based out of Portland. And he got in touch with me in January, sort of when main production on the film was sort of wrapping up. And he got in touch with me about the story that he wanted to do, and essentially he wanted to bring together you know, musicians and activists and artists to do sort of a traveling, like, animal rights, animal liberation festival. So in each city that we've gone to, we've done a screening of the film, a Q&A. We've often done sort of activist workshops, and we've done a protest in each city that we've gone to as well at a key location for animal experimentation. So, I mean, just 2 days ago we did a process at the Oregon National Primate Research Center, which has a really egregious history of Animal Welfare Act violations. And, I mean, it's a primate facility, so they deal with some pretty harsh studies in general. So that's essentially what the tour has been about, is going from city to city, really trying to energize people, meeting activists, working with local groups, seeing the film, playing music, doing protests. It's been a really, really great experience, and all of the credit really should go to Mike for organizing it. I've been obviously involved in bringing the film on tour and doing, you know, some of the stuff on tour, but Mike was the main organizer, and he's done a really, really fantastic job.
Yeah, that's amazing. We'll post the video about with Mike talking about the tour and everything on our website for sure. I think it's an amazing idea, grassroots, really invigorating. So you are coming to Vancouver Friday, August 3rd with your tour. I guess it's the last stop. And there'll be a screening at the downtown library at 7 p.m. It'll be followed by a Q&A with you and Mike?
It'll be with myself and Jennifer Bondock, who's one of the co-producers of the film.
Nice. And then, so we look forward to that. And that's a totally free event at the downtown library. And then will there also be other events in Vancouver that we can look forward to?
There's also a music event the following day. And I can't remember exactly the location of that event, but if people want to go on our website, www.openthecagestour.com, I believe it's openthecagestour.com/schedule, they'll be able to find all of the details for the Vancouver event.
Great. And do you have, so you're wrapping up this leg of the tour, do you have plans to expand the Open the Cages, the tour, beyond the West Coast?
There's been some discussion of that, but personally for me, I can't really engage in that discussion yet, because the film was really just completed about a month ago. We embarked on this tour pretty much right away. So I need to take some time off after this tour is done.
No.
To sort of recharge my batteries and my bank account and figure out what to do next. I mean, there will be screenings coming up in the fall, but I don't have solid details on any of that yet.
And then
I think if we were to do an Open the Cages tour, say, of the East Coast, I think it wouldn't be until spring of next year.
Right, and then also maybe the film festival circuit?
We're submitting to film festivals. Well, we've already submitted to it, and we're hoping that through those film festivals we might be able to attract a theatrical distributor or somebody who can help us get the film into mainstream as well.
Awesome. Well, that's all very exciting, and I'm sure you definitely deserve a break after this all wraps up. I guess we look forward to seeing you in about a week, and I want to thank you so much for your time, and best of luck with the film. I hope it reaches a huge, wide audience, and that you hear of lots of people seeking out support and leaving animal testing.
Thank you so much, and I really, really appreciate you having me on the program. It's really great to speak with you, and I'm really, really excited to show the film at the Public Library in Vancouver. I love all the different spaces that we've shown the film in, and I think doing it at a public library is a great idea, and I'm really thankful to Liberation BC and to Glenn for organizing that.
Yeah, they're a great gang, and we welcome you with open arms. So we'll see you soon, Carl, and thanks again.
You've been listening to the Animal Voices Radio Show here on 102.7 FM Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Coast Salish Territories, Canada. We here at Animal Voices ask you to keep connected with Animal Voices via the internet. You can do so by signing up on our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver, and join us on Twitter at Animal Voices YVR. Please do send us your suggestions and comments about the show either on Facebook or via email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. Also, please do check out our website, animalvoices.org, where our shows can also be downloaded from after the show, or you can even archive and view other previous shows. If you appreciate the work we do here at Animal Voices, you can help us out by making a donation at Animal Voices or at coopradio.org. And so now we're going to be leaving with a song. Stay tuned for Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Thanks for listening to Animal Voices today, and remember to be kind to the animals.
This is a song by Weird Visions, a song called Sigil, and it's featured prominently in Maximum Tolerated Dose.
Come to me now, then come.